Dr. Michael Matthews, professor of engineering psychology at the United States Military Academy, currently serving as a fellow with the Army Chief of Staff's Strategic Studies Group, and he is author of Headstrong, How Psychology is Revolutionizing War. His views are his own, not speaking for the Military Academy, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense. Writing in Foreign Affairs under the title Operation Sigmund Freud, Why the U.S. Military Needs a Surge in Psychology. Dr. Matthews, Mike, thank you for being on the program today. There are some who I imagine would believe that military psychology is an oxymoron. Why isn't it, Mike?
Well, you know, it's one of those fundamental, I think, truths of warfare that that we don't stop and reflect on much, that, you know, those militaries and leaders and soldiers who understand their enemy and, you know, from a psychological perspective and a social and cultural perspective are all things equal, are going to be a lot more prone to be successful in the battlefield. And let me add also that I think that my generation and probably those that have followed me, our views have been colored a lot by sort of the role of science and technology, you know, traditional hard science like physics and chemistry and biology following World War II, where we were, you know, as a nation, were preparing to potentially engage in warfare with a a peer adversary. And in those cases, well, having bigger, stronger tanks and ships and aircraft and F-35s these days and things of that nature were essential and still are as a deterrent. But in the types of warfare that we have found ourselves in the last, certainly in this century, and you can trace the roots back a little bit before that, we typically aren't going up against that sort of adversary who can sort of meet us one-on-one with technology. And I think under those circumstances, it's where psychology and more generally behavioral and social sciences become, you know, far more important in influencing victory and defeat.
You write about the comparison between the wars of the 20th and the wars of the 21st century, and you write, in the United States' most recent conflicts, the primary adversary hasn't been other countries, but rather ideologically motivated coalitions of fighters determined to achieve their political goals with unconventional tactics. And most of that has to do with the overwhelming ability of the United States to project power. I wonder, though, if that dynamic is maybe a little bit too stereotypical, because I read a book this summer called American Spring that was a recounting of the beginnings of the American Revolution in 1775, and I'm paraphrasing, but there was a letter from a British general back to London saying these savages won't stand and fight. They hide behind trees and rocks and whatever they can. And so I wonder if we maybe romantically forget that part of war and try to think about it just from a strictly kinetic point of view. We need to have more brute force than the other guy, and that's how we'll win.
I think you're absolutely right. And even though, you know, I'm sort of making the contention that psychology is more important now in some ways than it has been the last, say, 50 or 60 years, it's also the truth that it's one of those immutable aspects of war that, as I mentioned earlier, that a clever enemy, especially going up against someone who has more raw kinetic power, access to power than you do, can by employing new tactics, hit and run, we might call in the mid 20th century, we might have called them guerrilla tactics. Now we talk about asymmetric warfare. Hit the enemy at its weakest point, disappear before they can coalesce together and put kinetic power on you as the enemy. Those types of tactics, as you say, and the writer that you cite, were quite correct. It can be very successful.
Dr. Mike Matthews, currently serving as a fellow with the Army Chief of Staff's Strategic Studies Group, writing in Foreign Affairs magazine. His views are his own and not those of the Army or the Department of Defense. And you write, under these conditions, this type of warfare, this type of mind approach, powerful state-of-the-art military weapon systems have very limited utility. How does that inform the way that the military today, our military in particular, should approach its strategic plans, should approach the way that it develops leaders and commanders, and the way that it develops a force to combat these kinds of threats?
Francis, that's a broad question. I hope we can be on for 2 hours. There's a lot to that. You know, it's really kind of hard to know where to begin in respect to that. the military these days is I think in the military writ large, include all branches of the military, are in the face of budget constraints, very real budget constraints, and the changing sort of dynamics of the world, political scene, and so forth. They're kind of struggling to kind of redefine what a military should be in a nation such as ours. And I think it's particularly true for our ground forces, the Army, mostly, and to some extent the Marines. You know, what is the strategic value of land power, at least in the types of wars that we've been seeing? So, you know, when the ISIS/ISIL problem arose, you know, our response was to, as has been thus far, to use primarily air power and missiles and try to train some of the opposing forces for ground conflict. But our experience over and over again through the years, and let me quote Major General retired Bob Scales, Robert Scales, who's a great military strategist, one of the greatest in my mind in this century. And he talks about when we turn to using that type of military force for that type of mission to from a distance to subdue an enemy. He said quickly, just to paraphrase what he says in his book Yellow Smoke, that sort of the pyrotechnic effects or impact of bombs are quickly sort of lose their awe, and what was the phrase from 2003? Awe and
shock and awe.
Yeah, shock and awe to the enemy, and the enemy will simply go to ground, meaning that they literally hole up. As soon as the planes leave and the missile threat abates, they go back to doing, you know, their business. And so the enemy adapts, another immutable aspect of war. The enemy will always, they're always smart, they'll always adapt to our tactics. And so one argument would be that to really control a situation like that does take ground forces. And yet it's certainly an issue of strategic value and importance to our nation to decide, do we make that type of commitment under these circumstances for this particular threat? But the point of view that we would never really ever need large numbers of ground forces again, to me, seems implausible. That the day comes when you need to control the ground and the territory, having an army of ground forces who are smart about cultural matters, who understand how and when and where and appropriately use kinetic force as needed, but also can work with the population to really improve their lot, is really the ultimate solution. I know I've rambled a little bit on that, but it is a very broad question, and I think one that smart citizens who are paying attention to politics and America's role in the world need to pay attention to. So to say again, you know, what is the strategic land use of, what is the most appropriate strategic use of land force? And that's one aspect of it.
You see a light, though, at the end of the tunnel. You're right. The military can adapt to this new type of warfare. The first step will be to understand that terrorist organizations and other insurgent groups rely primarily on psychological manipulation to achieve their goals. How does that manipulation dictate the appropriate response from those of us who consider ourselves the good guys?
Well, I mean, when you reflect on ISIS's use of technology, Instagram to postings on Facebook and other media where they show these horrible beheadings and so forth. It seems like they've been ahead of us a little bit on capitalizing on that as a propaganda, if you will, sort of, you know, vehicle. You know, and in some ways, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, we've always, good guys and bad guys, to simplify it, have always utilized propaganda sources, whether it was paper or loudspeakers or whatever it may be. It's just now, you know, if ISIS can video something like that and in, you know, 3 milliseconds be available throughout the world, and they can then use that to stimulate support for their side, to gain recruits, to terrorize, cause fear in the populations that they're operating under, intimidate foreign nations who may want to otherwise intervene in some way or another. And here's where, again, I think there's a value to having soldiers, on the ground, and I emphasize, if the nation feels that's the right thing to do for that particular conflict, is because it's only then that you can come to understand the the local social geography, as it were, the culture, who the leaders are, both formal and informal. You know, what does the population need? How can the U.S. make things better for them? What are the important resources? What are the leverage points? What are the important events that are going on? You know, why is the local population buying or not buying into our agenda? You know, and things of that nature. So I'm somewhat optimistic because the Army, in particular, has been moving forward on developing expertise in this area. So I want to draw your readers or listeners, excuse me, attention to a new book that's coming out called Social Science Goes to War. I'll say that again, Social Science Goes to War by McFate and Lawrence, and that's coming out soon. And it describes a very interesting approach called the Human Terrain Team. Some of you may have heard of this a few years ago. But the Army started hiring little teams of four and training four and five member teams that were led by an anthropologist or a sociologist. They usually had an operator in uniform embedded in the team who would be deployed to a brigade or battalion operating in Afghanistan or Iraq. And their job is to go out and answer those types of questions like who are really the leaders around here? What do they want? What do they need? And, you know, how can we, as an armed force, come in and not make a mess of things, but make things better. And that book will describe for your listeners some really great successes in applying this sort of model, which is basically behavioral social science model, to making our strategic outcomes more attainable.
You write about the psychological care that the military could offer to its members. You write, 13 years of continuous war placed an enormous psychological burden on the all-volunteer force. As many as 15% of the military qualify as psychologically wounded. What's the implication of that? What can we expect in the future, and how do we deal with that?
Well, I was lucky enough to be involved in the very beginning with the Army standing up what they call the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program. And Comprehensive Soldier Fitness got its start around 2009, when the then Chief of Staff of the Army, George Casey, perceived that our suicide rates were way too high and we were having too many psychological injuries to include PTSD and depression and anxiety, to the point that a substantial number of soldiers were rendered, if not combat effective, at least less effective than they should be. And you think about our modern military, with the constraints of budget that we must work under. If you say I have just to make the math easy, an army of 500,000 soldiers, and if 10% of those are psychologically wounded, that's 50,000. Let's say if it was 15%, that's 75,000 soldiers who are not operating in an optimal way, many of whom may be at risk for suicide. If you could cut that in half by having more proactive, preventive sorts of measures in training and development for the soldiers, so they learn resilient skills before they deploy, and they learn that having a psychological issue is not something they should feel be a stigmatizing event for them, that over time we could create a more resilient and robust force, which really is a combat multiplier in terms of the number of soldiers you can keep, you know, sort of on the line, if you will. And so that was the rationale behind Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, and I think that that as we move forward in this century, psychology, technology, and our understanding of both from a psychological perspective, resilience and growth and pathology, but also understanding the neurobiology of those very same things, that knowledge is just really increasing exponentially, and we really stand in a good position to provide our soldiers with tools, be they, again, psychological training, or maybe, and this is farther out there, I mean, admittedly, but there may be, sort of neurobiological things we can do to help the brain be more resilient in the face of the adversity and stress soldiers are inevitably going to be faced with.
Mike, you use a word and you get at a phrase that was on my mind, both of them, as I read your piece in Foreign Affairs. The word that you used is stigma, and the phrase that you get at is the warrior mentality. And I wonder what your sense is of what has to happen or what the likelihood is that those things will happen, that stigma will recede and that men and women who have experienced psychological traumas will be able, willing to seek help and get some treatment?
You know, I think we're making some inroads in that. You know, comprehensive shoulder fitness has been somewhat controversial in some sectors, you know, from the standpoint of maybe it was rolled out too soon without enough, you know, evidence behind some, at least the components of the program, and that may or may not be. But one of the effects that we're finding with comprehensive shoulder fitness is I think we are getting at the goal of destigmatizing someone coming and asking and for treatment. So the model, we say, is clear to everyone who's listening that physical fitness is hugely important for soldiers. And when I say soldiers, I mean that very generically, just easier than saying airmen and sailors and Marines. So we'll just say soldiers, but it's everybody. And so if a soldier, you know, comes up lame in a run, or they played, you know, soccer that weekend, hurt their knee or something of that nature, they don't think twice about going to see a physician or other healthcare professional to get that fixed. And what CSF, Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, has done is to start making it somewhat more akin in the domain of emotional and mental health, so that it's not something to be ashamed of if you've been in horrific combat to have you know, sort of a lasting impact of that combat experience emotionally. And now we're seeing, I think, a greater acceptance on the part of our soldiers and to indeed seek out treatment. Some of that, we've changed our policy. At one point, if you sought mental health counseling, that could be reflected on your secret clearance or top secret clearance. And we've changed those rules, you know. So we're doing some things structurally as well as through things like CSF to destigmatize. And I think the Air Force and the Navy as are also having sort of parallel programs under different names they're rolling out as well.
Dr. Mike Matthews is on sabbatical from West Point, currently a fellow with the Army Chief of Staff's Strategic Studies Group, writing in Foreign Affairs under the title Operation Sigmund Freud, Why the U.S. Military Needs a Surge in Psychology. His views are his own and not those of the Army or the Department of Defense. You write in wrapping up this piece about where we've come from and where we can expect to go, and you made a reference earlier in our conversation to the concept of everything old is new again. You write, the cessation of major combat operations is often followed by a long period of asymmetric war. And you write, psychology's core competencies of understanding individual and group behavior then become the key to success. What is your view of how that key to success will successfully be used in the future, Mike?
I think it takes a will, a national will, and an understanding of policymakers to know that once we've gone in, I'll say this very colloquially, but gone in and broken things and defeated the kinetic enemy, that to leave too abruptly can leave a significant vacuum. So if you look back in time at World War II, what we did to reconstruct Germany and reconstruct Japan, we can look at those to one degree or another as a model of maybe how to do things right. And, you know, it is hard to compare different wars and different eras. You know, World War II, I think it was clearer. You know, my father fought in World War II. I always think of him on Veterans Day. He fought in the as a combat medic in the Pacific Theater for 14 months of continuous combat. Never said much about it, by the way. He just told me it was a big, long camping trip. I later found out after he died all the stuff he'd done. But they had a clear idea of what victory meant. You know, there was a nation that could surrender, and ultimately they did. And once that nation surrendered, I'm simplifying things, but it was somewhat clearer that it would be to the advantage of the United States and other progressive nations to go in and collectively to rebuild that nation in a form of a democracy. And it's worked very nicely, I think. It's harder, I think, when we've been at war, in a less well-defined war or wars, and that have gone on so long at such a great financial cost and cost in lives and the welfare of our soldiers, to think about spending that type of effort for that purpose. Does that make sense? So the point would be, I guess, that if if we're willing to go in and exercise our military force in traditional kinetic way, we probably owe it to those nations which we defeat to get them rebuilt and reorganized in such a way that they can be full partners in the world and progress. And I just think that it does come back to an issue of will, national will.